Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really, really excited about today's conversation with our two guests, who I'll introduce momentarily. But first, this is going to be the last in the installment of virtual discussions related to the technology issue of Sapir. Everyone should be on the lookout for our forthcoming issue entitled Friends and Foes, which should hit the digital stands in short order. But before we delve into what will happen, before we delve into the future, I want to rewind the clock back some 27 years. The date was May 11th, 1997. The place was New York City. The event was dubbed, quote, the rematch. All eyes from around the world were fixated on the 35th floor of the Equitable Center in Midtown Manhattan. This wasn't a boxing match or a basketball game. No. The outcome of this event would be far more consequential. This was a chess match between the youngest ever undisputed world champion, who held that title for 10 consecutive years, the chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, and his opponent, an IBM supercomputer named Deep Blue. Now, many of you on this call know or remember what happened on that fateful day in May 1997. By the 19th move of the sixth game between human and machine, the unthinkable happened. To quote the New York Times lead sentence the following morning, quote, in brisk and brutal fashion, the IBM computer Deep Blue unseated humanity, at least temporarily. The grandmasters in the audience were reportedly, quote, stunned into near speechlessness, because until that day in May, the notion of, quote, unseating humanity was the stuff of science fiction. But from that day on, the seemingly superhuman capacity of machines wasn't fiction, it was fact. And it wasn't just fact, it would also portend the future. In 2011, another IBM supercomputer named Watson defeated two Jeopardy champions. In 2016, Google DeepMind's AlphaGo program defeated a South Korean Go grandmaster, marking the very first time that an AI program unseated a top-ranked professional in the game Go. And for those proficient in Go or those who are not, it's basically a game that is significantly more complicated than checkers or chess. So the notion that machines can simulate human intelligence using, for example, neural networks that mimic brain function and apply it to solving problems and performing human-like tasks is, at the risk of being cliche, it's not a game. It's our newfound reality. I distinctly remember in 2018, Henry Kissinger, the former US Secretary of State, was so taken by AlphaGo's decisive win that he later penned an essay in The Atlantic wondering whether, quote, are we at the edge of a new phase of human history? So yes, artificial intelligence has been around for decades. But the introduction of ChatGPT last year made AI not just a household name, but a household product. These and other technologies are being developed at such a rapid clip that some might say we're living in the midst of a technological revolution that's transforming at warp speed every facet of our lives. And whether or not we are tuned to these stations, to these changes, whether we are attuned to these changes, these advancements also impact those of us in the Jewish community as well. And the question is, are we prepared? Should we be alarmed by the challenges posed by today's technologies on the Jewish individual, on Jewish institutions, on Jewish conceptions of the divine? Or should we be unfazed, perhaps even excited by the blessings that they endow? What will Jewish life look like in our technological future? We are fortunate to have two highly esteemed panelists and Sapir authors join us today to help unravel these questions and foster a conversation that must be had with more frequency in our community. Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter is among the preeminent scholars and leaders in Judaism today. He is a university professor of Jewish history and Jewish thought and a senior scholar at the Center for Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. He previously was the senior rabbi at the Jewish Center in Manhattan for 2 decades and co-founded the Torah Umada Journal. And he is the author of the Sapir essay, phenomenal essay, Jewish Technophobia, An Old Story. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Hanan. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to be here with you and to be here with David Zvi.
Thank you, Rabbi. And this gives me the opportunity to now welcome Dr. David Zvi Kalman, who is one of the most innovative thought leaders at the intersection of Jewish history and the history of technology. He's a research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute's Kagod Research Center, the owner of Printocraft Press, an independent publishing house, and he also blogs at Jello Menorah. And he also wrote a provocative and superb Sapir essay entitled Judaism at the Speed of Technological Change. Welcome, David Zvi.
Thank you, Hanan. Great to be here. Great to be with Rabbi Schachter.
So just a reminder to the audience, this is intended to be interactive. So please listen to everything Rabbi Schachter says and David Zvi says. And if you have questions, type it in the chat box. And throughout the conversation, we will aim to get to them in the final 20 minutes. All right, let's dive right in. Rabbi Schachter, Kvod Rav, let's start with you and hopefully on a positive, hopeful note. So reading your essay, I can't help but see you as like a, I don't know, a techno-optimist or at least maybe someone who's not a techno-pessimist, right? You talk about how AI may be new, but the challenge posed by new technologies to observant Jewish life, well, that's not new, right? We survived movable type, we survived the internet, we can survive AI. Maybe share with us what's the basis for your optimism if you actually agree on that caricature.
So once again, it's a great pleasure and a privilege for me to be here. I do want to take this opportunity to do something that I was not allowed to do in my essay, and that is to thank Saul Rosenberg for all of his help. He worked with me in preparing it. When I wanted to thank him, he said, "No, it's not the right policy. We don't do that." I do owe him, and I want to at least, if not in Torah Shebichtav, at least in Torah Shebaal Peh, at least orally express my gratitude to him. I also want to thank Rabbi Benjamin Samuels and an essay by Moshe Kopel that has helped me think through some of these issues. I came to this essay, and I am very grateful for having received the invitation from Sapir to participate in this very, very important issue. As somebody who is, I would say I was born too early for a lot of what is going on now. I'm basically a Luddite. I did not address the issues of what the future will bring, but as a historian, I went to my go-to safe, comfortable spot, and that is as a historian looking at the past. Well, basically, my essay says we've been around this block before. And we've had challenges before that we've been able to overcome. And the challenges that were posed by the internet were already posed before in printing. The blessings of internet we already experienced in printing. And so, as maybe a naive observer of the current situation, which I don't really fully grasp, although I'm beginning to grasp, my go-to conclusion is, you know what? We'll figure out how to do with this also. Yes, it's new, it's different. You gave two options before, Hanan. You said, should we be alarmed or should we be unfazed? So there's a middle ground. I'm neither alarmed nor unfazed. I'm quite fazed, but not alarmed. And that is, I have confidence that there's enough wisdom out there in the general world and in the Jewish world to figure out a way how to make this happen. And I hope specifically perspectives that I have will unfold in the course of this conversation.
Thank you, Rabbi. If I can just press on one of those on your point. So what gives you that sense of confidence? Is it just our long history that here we are? Look, in your background, a bunch of Svarim, right? This has guided us through the years. Someone in Daniel Bonner wrote in Sapir talking about the technological innovation of the book and basically the Sefer, how we use that to bring us from our origins till today. What gives you that sense of optimism?
Basically, I think the bottom line is that I can't believe that humankind, and in particular the Jewish tradition, does not have wisdom, thoughtfulness, insight to be able to deal with whatever challenges come our way. Humanity is not going to come to an end. Humanity will continue. That's my firm belief. And we will figure this out. Exactly how, I don't know. This is unprecedented. It's unbelievable. You know, the few examples that you cited, Hanan, at the beginning were really striking. Oh my God, for the first time, humanity has been bested. And that is just jaw-dropping. Yes, that's true, but we're not going away. And there's still space for the human condition, humanity with feeling, with emotions, and I hope to come back to this. And we're gonna figure this out. I have no idea how. It'll probably be long ago, maybe short after I'm already gone.
I want to get to that hopefully very distant future momentarily and pivot to you, David Zvi, because in your essay, piggybacking off of what Rabbi Schachter said, you highlighted how ChatGPT's debut induced a sense of worry in the public, and that more expansively, many of us live in a constant state of what you said is technologically induced anxiety. So, out of curiosity, where have you noticed this in the general public, and how has that concern materialized within the Jewish community in particular, if at all?
Well, thanks, Khan, for the question. I think there a lot of the people who are on this call right now have probably had a moment in the last couple of years where they have wondered whether the job they currently hold is going to exist in that format for as long as they want it to exist, or whether it's going to ch change in some kind of substantial way. I know that educators, including Jewish educators, have had to drastically revise their curricula, have had to rethink the kinds of tests and assignments they give, because the kind of goals that we had before things like ChatGPT and generative AI was available to the public no longer make sense. So I think there has been a kind of overnight overturning of both the employment world and then also the educational world. I think I, like Rabbi Schachter, am a techno-optimist. And one thing that I was reviewing the two essays. We both talked about the printing press as kind of like this model for like what it means to have a Jewish response to technology in a serious way. And Rabbi Schachter, you went in much greater depth than I could. So I really appreciate reading all the details you had, and like I was taking notes for later use. But what is interesting is that the reason we responded so strongly to the printing press is because we kind of had to, right? Like this is our bread and butter. I was thinking as an example of the way that when Elon Musk was taking over Twitter, everyone and their mother had opinions about it because Twitter is where journalists live. And so of course they're going to have this massive response, and you know, books, text, that's where rabbis live. And so like, of course they're going to have a massive response to the printing press. So, you know, I'm not worried about rabbis, Jewish leaders, Jewish thinkers having a kind of response or kind of being able to pull out texts when the need arises to deal with printing press or AI or whatever other kind of technological revolution. But I want to see something more. I want to see something beyond just the ability to kind of like wait out whatever storm and figure out how to kind of maintain some kind of something that's kind of like is maintained from era to era, and things don't just kind of all fall apart. There has to be something more. And what I think the more is that there is a recognition that AI is not just kind of this party trick. It's not just something which is, you know, coming and is going to be gone, but is actually going to have a massive impact on our world. And that impact could be positive, but is not necessarily going to be positive. And it's not always clear whether the people who are developing the technology are thinking about the general well-being of humanity in its development. And so there is a real concern there. And what I would like to see is more than just a question of Jews asking themselves, how do we weigh this out? To ask the further question of what can we contribute to the global conversation? Can we actually contribute something to make the way that this technology develops? Can we make that development better than it would have been otherwise? Through whatever means, I'm sure we can talk about the different kinds of means, but I want us to kind of step up to do more than the minimum.
Okay, we're going to get there momentarily. And I was going to ask you both. I also noticed that in reviewing your essays, you both reference the printing press. We're going to get there un momento, but this notion of a technologically induced anxiety that you reference, is that, you think, what's the basis for that? Is that because of a certain uncertainty about the potential impacts of these two new technologies on our lives? Where do you sense that? Why is that the case? Just to revert back to that question.
If you think about the way the technologies have kind of been introduced to American homes over the last couple hundred years, it used to be kind of slow, right? If you think about how long it took from the invention of the telephone to the time when the telephone is present in most American households, or the refrigerator, the microwave, it takes often decades for these things to happen. The time between a technology's development and its wide-scale implementation is now years, months. Right. Even though we are now kind of, we're still kind of stunned by the development of AI, there is now a million companies that are startups trying to get money to develop these technologies in ways that will affect our lives in all kinds of disparate manners. So I think there is a real concern that this is developing. It's developing because there's certainly a lot of there's a financial incentive there. And it's something that for most of us who are not in the financial sector, we have very little to say. We have very little, ability to shape the course of the development of these technologies and just kind of to sit back and say, like, well, if this is what everyone else is doing, I guess I'm doing it too, because the network effects around technologies like these are just so strong. And you don't want to get left out, either from an employment perspective, from a social perspective. And that can cause a lot of anxiety because you're kind of pulled into that future.
Rabbi Schachter or WC talked about how you both referenced the printing press, right? This is like in the last 600, 700 years, the most transformative innovation that changed how information and ideas spread. And it was banned, I think, as you referenced in Salonika, by some rabbinic leadership. Just like the internet was banned in different parts of the Haredi community 15, 12 years ago, right? In 2011, and then subsequently, I think AI, you write about how it was banned by different parts of our community. Do you view artificial intelligence as simply the printing press of our time, or should we be a little bit more circumspect about it?
I first want to say just the following, that you're calling me Rabbi Schachter and you're calling David Zvi David Zvi. So that makes me uncomfortable. So either I'm JJ or he's Dr. Kalman. So I think that's just the appropriate thing to do. I appreciate it, Hanan, but I'm a guy, and I think that that's important. I'm very always uncomfortable with somehow being called out on a different way than people with whom I appear and for whom I have a great deal of respect. So you are Dr. Weissman, Rabbi Weissman. I mean, let's.
I'm married to a Dr. Weissman.
You're married to a
But
Dr.
I'm a
Weissman,
mister.
so that's
Yes.
wonderful. And Dr. Kalman. So I'm going to say Dr. Kalman. No, the answer to your question is I think, as Dr. Kalman pointed out, we are in, and you did at the beginning, we are now in a totally different galaxy. I think that what we are confronting now is absolutely, totally unprecedented and is anxiety provoking. I agree with Dr. Kalman that we're now treading on untreaded ground. What's my job going to look like? It's going to be very different. How will I educate my children and my students? What will I expect that they need to know is going to be very, very different. I'll tell you a story. I received an essay of a student who was applying to a Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University, and I was convinced that she didn't write the essay. I happened to know her family. I spoke to her father, and he said, "Well, what do you mean? She just went on ChatGPT and she wrote the essay." As if there was absolutely not a question that that was utterly appropriate. And I was taken aback. It's so ubiquitous. It's so part of the conversation. So how are we going to measure college acceptance? I mean, there are a million different areas and ways that this is going to upend the way business is being done as usual. So I share the anxiety, but I also share the fundamental I don't know, optimism in the human condition that we're not going to just fall apart. We're going to figure out a way how to do it. And I appreciate Dr. Kalman's insistence and pushing us, not just to be reactive, but to be proactive. That was in some of the other essays in this magnificent issue of technology put out by Sapir. It's not just we're going to catch up and make do, but what can we, and here in particular the Jewish community, Jewish thought, Jewish history, Jewish theology, contribute to this conversation going forward? I think that we're not businessmen. I think it's correct. I think they're driving this. And to some extent, we need to be and will be reduced to be catching up. It would be nice if we could figure out a way how to have a partnership with those who are in the technology of this, with those who are in the thought leaders of this, to figure out a way how to speak to one another and maybe help shape the direction of how this incredibly quick moving phenomenon is unfolding.
That's perfect, segue, Rabbi Schachter, for a question for you, Dr. Kalman. And that is related to this notion. And it seemed to be clear in your reading your essay that you believe, as Rabbi Schachter points out, businessmen, innovators are the ones leading the charge here. My sense from you is you think that Jewish leaders, whether they're rabbinic, whether they're Jewish communal leaders, are simply unprepared to deal with the velocity of changes that these new technologies will impose on Jewish life now and into the future. So not just life as humans and the challenges that many of us face regardless of our religious identity, but that in particular, that Jewish communal leaders and rabbinic leaders aren't necessarily ready for this moment. Am I reading you correctly in that respect? And how can you tell that's the case if that is what you're arguing?
Anecdotally, I feel like it's definitely correct. I've spoken over the last year and a half or so with a lot of Jewish leaders who feel like they are concerned both in terms of their own work, in terms of how to say something meaningful about these technologies, and yet don't know how, either because it feels like it's inevitable, it's going to happen anyways, or just because on a technical level, it's just kind of hard to take in and say something that's actually intelligent about an entire field of work that's hard to do. And I think it's commendable that a lot of Jewish leaders have nonetheless tried to make that transition. But I also think there's a kind of a supply demand issue here, where if you take Jewish leaders who, like, their bread and butter is not commenting on technology problems, and you tell them, well, okay, like, now we want you to be like an AI expert, we want you to kind of like be a big thinker in this field, they're gonna be like, I have a job, I have other things to do, why would I do that? I think this is part of thinking about what does it mean to develop the notion of Jewish leadership itself such that it can accommodate the kinds of people who say, I am committed to, being a leader for the Jewish people, but the way I want to be a leader to the Jewish people is also in conversation with these technological developments that are happening in the world around us. And we have examples of that, right? We have examples of Jewish leaders, not in technology, but in other sectors of Jewish life, in the civil rights movement, have been involved far beyond simply what is kind of like inside the Jewish camp. So I think there is a kind of like immediate need to think like, what does it mean for a Jewish leader today in the context of their synagogue, their school, their institution to develop new ideas and new thinking about this? And at the same time, there's a question of how do you bring people who might otherwise go on to become engineers and say, actually, we want you to develop those ideas and be in those conversations, but from the perspective of religious ethics.
So I'm piggybacking off of some of that, Dr. Kalman. You believe that Judaism has been a moral leader in the past and can be a moral leader only by proactively providing guidance on some of these moral problems that emerge from these technologies, right? You cited the civil rights movement in ways that Jews have been out front on that particular issue. What's an example of a moral problem that will emerge from these technologies that you think Jewish communal leaders, Jewish rabbinic leaders should be at the forefront on?
So I would put them in a kind of couple categories. There are problems where the most that Jewish leaders can hope to influence the environment is in just by providing good moral frameworks. So, for example, There is an existing school of thought, a school of thought which, to me, to my mind, is kind of dangerously ascendant, that imagines AI as a kind of God, and AI is kind of like the part of a new developing religion. To my mind, that strikes me as kind of like verging on idolatry, in a really literal sense. And I think it also provides a lack of accountability for people who are developing those technologies. I think there's a way to kind of frame, to use metaphors, to use language around what it means to develop AI that is more like a child, that is more like something that is in our image, the way that, you know, we are in God's image. So like there is ways in we can develop language, and even use the kind of the midrashic tools that we have within the Jewish tradition, to think about not just on a kind of technical level, like what, you know, what is the policy for this particular moment, but how do I think about the policies in general? That's one piece. The second piece is that there are many Jewish leaders who do have control over local institutions, and they can think about, for example, do we think that facial recognition technology is acceptable to use within our school, within our shul, within our within whatever institution, within our JCC. Those are important locally. I think those are also useful as models for that other institutions can copy, in the same way that we've seen in the last decade or so, the notion of, not even the last decade, last several decades, the notion of Shabbat, which is like not, you know, non-enforced nationally, is a kind of inspiring model for, you know, a way to engage with technology that is healthier for society overall. So it's not a kind of direct influence, but people see what is successful, and people who are looking for better, healthy relationships with technologies can use those as examples for themselves.
Just a reminder to everybody, if you have any questions, please insert them in the chat box, and we're going to aim to get to them in about 10 or so minutes. And you can direct it at any one person or both of our esteemed panelists. And if you want to remain anonymous, please just write that at the top. Otherwise, I will gladly say your name. Rabbi Schechter, I want to actually build on something that Dr. Kalman mentioned, but also something that we've seen in different parts of the issue on technology. And that's the argument that Andrei Spokoinoi makes in the piece, where he says that the questions that face us today, there are few Jewish responses, and where there are these responses, they tend to be halachic rather than theological. They tend to focus on whether something is, quote, like allowed or forbidden within like the legal framework. But the questions that we're talking about today, which Dr. Kalman referenced, actually go to this very notion of a conception of humankind and what constitutes a God or a divine. Are you seeing some of those questions in the context of your own work, in the context of your rabbinic colleagues, regarding the theological and the philosophical questions that derive from a machine that can produce things without necessarily a human hand?
So I want to agree with Dr. Kalman, and that is that I'm not seeing a robust focus within the circles of Jewish leaders and intellectuals with whom I interact on this challenge. I'm a yeshiva university, so the yeshiva part, we're in the Beit Midrash, and we're sitting and learning like we sat and learned 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 80 years ago. And there's really not that much changing, and really not an awareness of the cataclysm that has struck and will strike with even greater ferocity in the general world and obviously within the Jewish world. So I'm not really seeing that. But I do want to speak to the issue of not just a halachic context, but a theological context. Because I think that's very important. I think it's important for the Jewish community to think broader. Obviously, I consider halacha to be centrally important, but I think it's important. I want to draw a lesson from a Talmudic text that is actually, I think, very germane and very relevant. Some of the conversation that has evolved around this issue of ChatGPT and AI has been going back to what is known as the golem. There's been this magical, unbelievable creation of a something that is human-like. Well, it turns out that that is already in the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin 65b. The Talmud tells us Rava bara gavra, that Rava actually created a person, and Rashi explains that he took a look at some mystical texts and figure out a way how to align the letters and was able to somehow, I have no idea what I'm talking about, but somehow to be able to create a person. And he sent it to Rabbi Zeira. And Rabbi Zeira spoke to this, let's call it an entity, but he didn't answer. The entity did not answer. Said Rabbi Zeira, clearly you are the creation of one of my colleagues. You were clearly created artificially, and therefore you have no right to exist. And he went ahead and said, Hadar la'afarech, return to your dust, and did away with it. Now, this is not a halachic context. This, to me, is a theological context. In other words, you're a human creation, and so you don't really have ultimate theological value. Now, in the context in which we find ourselves today, there is tremendous value, and there are a lot of upsides, and I think it's important for us to focus not just on the challenges, but the incredible contributions that potentially comes from this unfolding of this technology. But this conversation in the Talmud is the theological conversation. You know, later on in the 17th century, there's a Rabbi Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi who had an ancestor, Rabbi Elia Baal Shem, who created a golem. And he wants to know, can you count the golem for a minyan? I mean, that's really the question. Does he count for a quorum? So I mean, it doesn't get more specifically halachic than that. And the answer is you really can't count to a quorum because after all, Rabbi Zeira killed it. So obviously it's not a human, so it doesn't count. It can't count to a quorum. And that's great and that's beautiful. But I think the larger question, and I think that's where Dr. Kalman was taking us, and where you want to go, and where I wish I could go with a little bit more wisdom than I have, is to frame this in a much broader level. And it, I think, in this space, and I don't know how yet, is where the Jewish community can contribute proactively to the larger discussion about how this technology is unfolding. What's the value of it? How do we perceive of it? What role does it play? What place does it have in a larger human reality?
All
So
right,
I think
Doctor,
there
if I
is,
can. Oh, sorry.
no, I'm done. I'm done. Yeah, I think there is some move in that direction, but I think this Talmudic text needs to be reanalyzed and utilized. Yes, Dr. Kalman, please.
Oh, I just wanted to kind of put an exclamation point on what you were saying, because one thing that I find so frustrating is that I see the golem analogy show up all the time in AI context. It's been showing up in those contexts for basically like a 70, since the 60s, since the AI project began. And yet somehow all those stories conveniently forget that most of the golem stories in the Jewish tradition end with a golem being destroyed because it is dangerous. In a sense, it actually cannot survive in the world. And somehow there's a kind of interest in the beginning of the story, and we'll forget about the end of it. The end of it's not so important for our purposes.
So the golem ends up being killed. In fact, Rabbi Elia Baal Shem, the son of Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi was Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Jacob Emden. I wrote my dissertation on Emden. I've spent 45 years on Emden. My next book is a critical edition of his autobiography. And right at the beginning, he tells the story about his great-great-great-grandfather, who was so frightened by the power of this entity that he created, that he pulled God's name off of its forehead. One version has it that he asked him to tie his shoes and it bent down and he was able, and then it just clumped into dust and mud and it actually injured him. So we killed him. AI isn't going away. We're not killing them. So that's one important parallel here. You know, the golem story, and you're 100% right. You know, we created a golem, but we were able to kill it. And the second thing is, I want to introduce this Talmudic text, which is generally not part of the Golem conversation, which I would say is the pre-Golem Golem. Already in Tractate Sanhedrin, somebody created a person. And there is a theological insight that I think needs to be further unpacked in this context.
Fascinating. And I think behooves all of us to look up that piece of Gemara.
65b, Samach Hei Amud Bet. Go for it.
Okay.
Dr. Kalman, I can't wait to read what you're going to come up with from this passage.
There are expectations there, Dr. Kalman. So Rabbi Schachter, actually, and I actually want to do take it out to the halachic realm, and then we'll delve into questions from our audience. I don't know if either of you ever heard of this podcast. It's called Halacha Headlines. The moderator, this was last summer, was asking a series of rabbinic authorities in the Orthodox community and parts of the Haredi community, if in 20 years you were able to like teach a computer to be a huge lamdin, right? Someone who's able to learn the text of the Talmud and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and all these rabbinic texts, and you can test it, and it knows all the information. Are we allowed to encourage people to ask questions of rabbinic authorities, questions of this, you know, supercomputer? Let's say, again, like a Deep Blue for a halacha, or a Watson for Jewish law. Is there any realm in which you can bake in some of these artificial intelligence questions, and it could serve as an official response to people who have those shilas, those questions?
Are you addressing that to me? Actually, this I've given some thought to. And here again, I think the internet is a bit of a precedent. In other words, so can I ask my question to the internet? Can I, can I consult Rabbi Google and ask Rabbi Google what to do under certain circumstances? So I think it depends, you know, if it's what blessing do I make on rice cake, or until when can I recite the Shema this morning? So I think it is appropriate, and it has been appropriate, and it will continue to be appropriate. And I think to the extent to which those answers might be even more answered in a more sophisticated way with the new technology, then bevakasha, go ahead and do it. But I have serious, serious reservations on both ends, namely on the end of the person who is making the determination and on the end of the person who is asking for the determination. And here, if I may, I'll just speak to one of them and I'll take a moment. A posek, a halachic decisor. So the assumption is that the halachic decisor, when asked the question, you know, punches in certain pieces of knowledge, correlates the question with what that person knows, checks a few sources, and we're good to go, and churns out an answer. Turns out that that's not how it works. And here I want to draw upon my teacher and I guess my Rebbe, Rabbi Joseph D. Soloveitchik, who wrote something that to me was really astounding and that I think needs to be taken into consideration. The question that was posed was, during the Korean War, there were a number of students at Yeshiva University who chose not to join the chaplaincy. They were rabbinical students. They did not want to go into the chaplaincy. And there was a great need for chaplains. And Rabbi Soloveitchik addressed a 40-page letter to the then president of Yeshiva University, Dr. Samuel Belkin, arguing in favor of insisting or certainly promoting strongly chaplaincy for Yeshiva University rabbinical students. The way he begins the 40-page essay letter is as follows. I'm walking into this with a preconceived answer. Don't think for a second that I am totally tabula rasa, and I'm now going to analyze the sources and see where they take me. I cannot lay claim, I'm quoting, to objectivity if the latter should signify the absence of axiological premises and a completely emotionally detached attitude. There's no absence of values here, axiological values, meaning the good in this conversation. The halachic inquiry, like any other cognitive theoretical performance, does not start out from the point of absolute zero as to sentimental attitudes and value judgments. There always exists in the mind of the poseic a certain ethico-axiological background against which the decision is going to be made. And so there is this incredible human component on the part of the decisor, which ChatGPT, AI, you name it, will not have. As sophisticated as it's going to be, it will know a ton. It will know more than any human being. It will have levels of knowledge beyond human comprehension. But it will not have, I don't believe, it speaks the language of emotion. You know, frankly, one Haredi writer wrote that it's much worse than the internet. The internet we know is our enemy, but ChatGPT fakes us out because it speaks warmly and sweetly. It's like Esav being our brother. It's so dangerous. So it speaks that, and it reflects that, but it's not that. I don't believe. Maybe I'm naive, and maybe I'm a Luddite, and maybe I don't know what this could be one day, this new technology. But a certain rabbinic intuition that is honed from years of study of life, and different decisors are different. You can't plug in a formula. So I don't see asking, and I'm talking about not what blessing do I make on a rice cake. I'm talking about serious questions that people grapple with. And then just very quickly on the end of the questioner, to come back to Rabbi Soloveitchik, I stood with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I studied in Boston in graduate school, and I went to his shiur on Sunday mornings. And I always used to go over to get the hak, you know, after the shiur. It's not just the shiur, but quite, and I would stand there just as a fly on the wall. And week after week after week, people would ask him questions. It would be the same question, and he would answer differently. And Rabbi Soloveitchik has been accused of, you know, to me, he said this, to you, he said this, because he took into consideration the person who's asking the question. What are the life circumstances? What does he know about this person? What does he know about the family of this person? What does he know about the challenges of this person? It's not cookie cutter. I can't imagine that ChatGPT or AI or whatever is going to be created will have that nuance. There's this human nuance that is not replicable, that is very individualized and very sensitive, very thoughtful, very interior. So it's both from the side of the question. I'm sorry I'm taking too long, but you didn't stop me yet. Both from the side of the questioner and the side of the answerer. Yeah, you can ask certain questions, but I don't believe this is going to overtake the role of rabbinic authority in any really significant and serious way.
That's a fascinating anecdote. I want to actually build on that, Rabbi Schachter, and go to some of the questions, go to the virtual hack, if you will, in these last 14 minutes. Donnie Engelhart, building off of what you just said, says that in the Jewish tradition, wisdom and scholarship were always embodied in a person who came to be esteemed based on merit. So, for example, Rav Soloveitchik. What happens when AI begins finding insights in Torah or Talmud? Do you predict, and this is to both of you, that smart technology will make our rabbis and the Jewish population as a whole sharper or duller by virtue of these technological innovations?
Dr. Kamen, why don't you take that first, since I spoke too long just now?
So what I'd say, and I think this is also, Rabbi Schachter, a kind of addition to what you were saying, there is an advantage in the use of AI around the study of Torah. And the advantage is that nobody makes money from studying Torah, or almost nobody makes money from studying Torah. Meaning like the questions that we normally ask around AI and mathematics, AI and pedagogy generally are often around what is the best use of our time, best use of students' time. For Torah study, it's a little bit different because what you're trying to solve for instead is how do I make this the best experience possible? And if what you're trying to solve for is how do I make this the best experience possible, then it's not just about questions of like, can I ask Is this dish, can I eat off of it or not, or things like that? You're asking these broader questions of how do I integrate this as one in a long series of digital technologies that Jews have integrated into the Torah study? How do I integrate it in such a way that it makes Torah study richer? And I have a lot of confidence. I think one of the most underreported stories of the last 60 years is that there is this basically stream of what I call pious coders, people who are coming from a
Could you
coding
say it again?
background,
What'd you say?
pious coders, people who are they code for a living, but they're interested in developing Torah. And so it's because of that that we have the digitization of all of Torah, that we have all these translations available freely at our fingertips, that we have the Kairos Geniza that is being analyzed both by people and by computers to find new texts, to find linkages between texts that may be housed in archives in different parts of the world. All of that is because people see the study of Torah as being valuable in and of itself. So I have a lot of confidence that there is going to be the integration of AI into Torah study that is not just trying to solve problems, not just trying to like make it, a substitute for a rabbi or a substitute for kind of whatever exists right now, but that there will be all kinds of new creative ways in which AI is used to literally, figuratively animate Torah study in such a way that you bring Maimonides to life. You bring all kinds of other people to life. And it's not just a question of kind of solving problems. Of course, the issue that can come with that is a kind of ossification. If you treat Torah as being all the things that have existed so far and none of the things that exist afterwards, then there is the possibility of kind of confirming existing trends, existing biases. I think there's a strong concern about kind of minimizing the development of Torah written by women and feminist Torah, because that's mostly not what is represented in the tradition at the moment from a sheer quantity of words perspective. So I want to make sure that these tools are integrated in such a way that they don't block off the possibility and actually encourage the possibility of creating more and new kinds of Torah.
That's phenomenal. I want to get to as many of these questions as we can. Hernan Garcia asks, maybe Rabbi Schachter, we'll start with you. What will be our ethical responsibility if or when one of these machines becomes sentient?
Becomes what?
Sentient. Sentient. Becomes
What does that mean?
meaning it could feel, it could. There's a notion of consciousness. It is able to see
I don't
things.
know. I'm not able in my mind to wrap myself around the notion that a machine could become human. A machine can act like a human. And here again, maybe I'm just displaying my ignorance, but that a machine could become human and have a soul and have a conscience. I want to defer my answer to that question until that is going to happen. I'm just having trouble conceiving of something like that. I want to come back to the previous question because I think Dr. Kalman is 100% correct. Talmud Torah is not just an intellectual exercise. The study of Torah is an emotional exercise. I am emotionally invested. I feel emotionally enriched. It's not just that I learned something and I have now captured a new piece of knowledge, but I have internalized values. On my good days, I may even feel closer to God. Rare, but that would be a good day. I feel closer to my potential as a human being. And I don't think, yes, I think the knowledge is going to make us much, much sharper, but it's not a substitute, not to, I believe, rabbinic authority, properly and appropriately demonstrated, and not as a substitute to the emotional experience of the study of the text.
Just to piggyback off of that question, there's this notion, right? This notion of artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which is this conceit that these systems will be able to perform any task that a human can. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean it will be human, but it will be able to replicate some of those capabilities. And a lot of individuals within the artificial intelligence space will make the argument that this notion of AGI will be developed within the next decade. Now, those outside of the artificial intelligence space are a little bit more skeptical, but I think within this century, people would make the argument that AGI is upon us, that it's something that we have to consider as, if not around the corner in our immediate lifetimes, certainly in our children's lifetimes and the like. And so, how do
What
we
does it mean
contend?
to act as a human? Does it mean to act as a human or to be a human?
Dr. Common, how do you respond to that?
I would tend to say that the kind of the ontological questions of is there a soul, is there not a soul, are less important, in part because to some degree they may be unanswerable. I am more concerned about trying to create an increasingly difficult distinction between these machines that present in all kinds of ways as human, provoke emotional responses in us as humans, and the actual human beings. And what I am worried about is ending up in situations, especially online, where you're experiencing only kind of a person through their text or through, or through the sound, but not their actual body. I'm concerned about situations where people will be mistaken, like kind of erring on the side of non-humanity, and people being increasingly at going to great lengths to kind of assure those that they're interacting with, like, no, I really am a person. I really do deserve the respect that human beings are treated, ought to be given. So what I would say because of that is I would actually err on the side of offer more humanity, that it actually makes more sense to preemptively provide to AI some measure of humanity, some of the pr not privileges, but the ways of speaking that we offer to human beings, and that when we develop AIs and we put them out into the world, we should be doing so with the understanding that they are often going to be treated like human beings. And I think that presents much more of an onus on the developers to make sure that they're putting AIs into the world in a reasonable fashion and are not trying to trick people. But I'm concerned about the kind of the ontological question, like getting stuck on that and then kind of missing out on the question of what actually happens in the real world. The real world, people are interacting with machines all the time, thinking that they're people. There's a question in the chat about AI Havrutas. There are AI Havrutas in the world already. I mean, like, people are interacting, they're chatting with machines, kind of like the way they're chatting with people already. So I would rather err on that side than err on the other side.
What do you mean by err on that side?
Meaning,
Erring on that.
I would say I think people are often concerned about what it means to give AI personhood or AI some measure of humanity, because they're thinking about other conversations we have in the American context around fetal personhood, around animal personhood, animal personhood, that what it means to say something has personhood means it has rights. And they're concerned about, like, that rights will end up impinging on the rights of other human beings or human beings. I think that is less of a helpful framing. I think it's more helpful to think about bestowing some measure of personhood on AI as actually benefiting humanity, benefiting humans who are already in danger of being confused for AIs and their work being degraded because it is being confused for AIs, and a kind of general degradation of many of the things that we used to think of as being kind of unique to us as human beings, because we're like, well, now an AI can do it, so who cares? It's not really important that a human being can also do it. So I worry about us going down that path. I worry about a kind of a loss of humanity among actual human beings because of those things. I think we can, and we have the ability as a culture to kind of separate out those questions of, like, rights and responsibilities and how we treat others into different camps. So we don't have to say, like, well, if you, like, go down that path and, like, all of a sudden, AIs are fully people, and therefore they are, there's this list of rights that you have to bestow on them. I think we can do some more careful work. And I would even say, this is probably a different conversation, that there is within the Jewish tradition the tools to understand that there can be degrees of personhood around fetuses, around kind of different kinds of beings, and that actually that provides some kind of a guide path for what it might mean to think about personhood with respect to AIs as well.
That's a very interesting point. I want to think more about it. And you're suggesting that the way we understand the being that is represented by AI or ChatGPT actually affects our humanity, that the way we are humans is is a function of how we perceive of this strength or this entity or this new technology. That's a very interesting point. Thank you.
Just one final question for both of you. I was talking to a colleague of mine, and he made the really, I think, intriguing argument that Judaism in and of itself might be conceived as a technology, as a certain social technology in terms of how it engineers community and how, in terms of how it engineers individual behavior. You know, the technology that the Shabbat offers for us provides certain moral and spiritual goals for us as well. We've seen a lot of remarkable innovations using technology. Digital Torah, for example, like Sefaria, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary. I'm curious if you can each, and maybe we'll start with you, Dr. Kalman, and end with you, Rabbi Shachter, talk about in a minute a piece, and no longer how, what gives you certain hope about how we'll contend with the future of the Jewish tradition and the Jewish community in this type of technological future. Dr. Kalman?
So just on the question of technology, sure, I don't see why not. The ways that we use the word technology have changed a lot in the last century. The way that we use it today is really only something that showed up in the last 60 years or so. So if people want to call Judaism a technology, I don't see a problem with that. What I think Judaism does have to offer, though, is there is a way in which technology has a kind of tendency to erase its own past. We have technologies that literally replace the technologies that came before them without, and because of that, we often lose the kind of lived experience, the practice of how to relate to those old technologies, how to have good lives with those old technologies. I think what Judaism allows us to do is say, yes, we can have new technologies. Yes, we can develop into the future, but the past remains important, and it remains important to have that long, long, long history of the way in which we've lived and what it means to exist well around our tools.
Beautiful. Thank you. Rabbi Shachter?
I may be wrong and I stand corrected, but I see technology as different from emotion. I see technology as different from interior, from feelings. And so I am uncomfortable, given that definition, should it be even remotely correct, seeing Judaism as a technology. Yes, of course, it tells you what to do. It has a lot of laws. We have Sefaria. We have all kinds of wonderful blessings. But that Shabbat is technological. Shabbat is so interior. It's so personal. It's so deep. It's so meaningful. It's so restorative. It's so restful. I just see it on an entirely different plane. So I would like to separate out the technological aspects of Judaism, of which there are many, and you gave a number of examples. And what I'm at this naive stage of my life are calling non-technological, and that is the personal, the interior, the feeling, the emotion. And Shabbat is that, and so much of Judaism. It's not just the formal compliance with the law, but it's the law as a living experience. There's a flavor, there's a warmth, there's a scent, and I'm quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik now, to mitzvot and to life. So my final comment is, let's take it on. This is exciting. This is great. This is incredibly meaningful. It's a blessing. It's a challenge. We're up for it. And with the likes of Dr. Kalman and others, we're going to do really well in trying to figure this out.
I love it. Amen. Deep hakara tov, appreciation to Rabbi Jacob J. Shachter and Dr. David B. Kalman. If you haven't yet had an opportunity to read their essays in the technology issue of Sapir, please, I encourage you to do so. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, also please be on the lookout for our forthcoming issue entitled Friends and Foes. It will be a doozy. And as always, please reach out to us at sapirjournal.org. And thank you for being part of the broader Sapir community.